speaker for this evening, Rabbi Schechter, asked me not to give him an introduction, so I will cut down the introduction significantly. I'll just say that Rabbi Shai Schechter is an absolute incredible Talmud Chacham and really mentor, representative of and to all of us in the Jewish community, in the Jewish world. He's the rabbi of the Young Israel of Woodmere, where he lives in that community with his wife Rina and his children. He's also the rabbi. It just gives you a sense of his breadth of Yachad, the organization for individuals with disabilities under the Orthodox Union. He's the rabbi, camp rabbi at Camp Simcha for High Lifeline. He has smicha at YU, both, of course, from Yeshiva University, where he learned with his father for many, many, many years. As a student myself at YU, all I could remember was Rabbi Shai Schechter sitting next to his father, Rabbi Herschel Schechter, day after day, month after month, sitting and learning together. And he has smicha from Rabbi Asher Weiss in Yerushalayim as well. Rabbi Schechter, it is a kavod gadol for all of us that you are here to address us during the month of Elul, just as we're approaching Rosh Hashanah this evening, and certainly an incredible ilui for the neshama of Johnny. Thank you, Rav Schechter.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Grauer. And I can say it's really a humbling privilege to have been asked to participate in this evening. I know Marsha and Michael, we have never met in person, but what can I say? There isn't really much to say, other than the fact that the Gemara tells us in Maseches Baba Kama that when Chizkiyahu HaMelech passed away, the Pasuk tells us, V'kavod gadol asu lo b'moso. They did something extraordinary in his memory. And the Gemara wonders, what can a person do that is so extraordinary? What can you do that will give such great honor to one who is deceased? And the Gemara says, Malamed Shehoshivu Yeshiva Al Kivro. The greatest honor that one can ever bestow upon a person, upon a human being, is that Torah study should be learned in their memory. So what you have contributed and what you have done with your incredible contributions to the entire Tzurva program, which is an international program, it's a phenomenal program. And it's something that you have dedicated in memory of both Jonathan and Ethan. And we are incredibly indebted to you for your dedication to this project. And it's my hope that through this great kavod, through this incredible gift that you have given Jonathan and Ethan as well, that their neshama will have an aliyah. So tonight, obviously, is just a very small sampling of what it is that this Tzurva program really offers, and we're not going to have an opportunity to learn. I was put on a very tight schedule here. We're not going to have an opportunity to learn through the packet, but I'm offering on behalf of the Tzurva program that anybody who's on here who's interested in seeing the amazing booklet that is so user-friendly and so clear and so concise and so easy to learn from, that was put together just on some of the laws of Rosh Hashanah. I'm certain that you will enjoy it. And I'm sure that the Mizrahi is happy to send it out for all of you to appreciate and study over the next few weeks or during the Yantuf season itself. There's so much there. I can say my 10-year-old son, when I was sent the latest Sefer that the Laxes had sent out, my 10-year-old son, who I did not encourage him, but he saw it on the table, and he has almost finished it. And I think it's a testament to how clear and concise the information is. I can't say that he understood everything, but I think the fact that he can even scroll through it and get something and really have an appreciation for the depth of the halacha that is presented there is an unbelievable testament to the entire Tzurva program. So thank you for taking this on, for honoring the legacy of your children in the highest possible way that one can ever do so. And I'm really, as I said, extremely humbled to have been asked to participate in this evening's program. I'm going to transition to something that may sound a little bit uncomfortable, but really it's just a contrast, a story that we read in the Chumash last week, and to glean a message that is very relevant to tonight's topic. Just last week, we read a story about the Ben Sora Umore, and obviously it's strange to talk about a wayward son when it's quite clear that your children were quite the opposite. What we heard from Rabbi Leibowitz was so moving and so touching, and really so telling about who Johnny was and about what his lasting legacy will be forever. But the Torah tells us there a story about a child who has embezzled money from his parents. And the Torah says that this child has involved himself in excessive and gluttonous eating habits and has fallen prey to the insatiable desires of the world. In what seems to be, at least in my estimation, almost a callous and unsympathetic response, the Torah says there's no recourse at all, and we must immediately take this child's life. We are not to give them any opportunity. There's no second chances. And I've always found this story very troubling. Can it really be that a child who just simply doesn't know appropriate boundaries, a child who doesn't know appropriate limitations, somebody who doesn't know restrictions, is deserving of the death penalty? How is that possible? Why don't we give the child a fair chance and then leave his fate to be determined over time? Why don't we carefully observe how he turns out over life and see how he's going to mature and how he's going to develop and then make a determination whether it makes sense for this child to have the gift of life or not? And the Gemara concludes, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, there are some people who are nidon al shem sofo. The Gemara says unequivocally that we could already predict a downward spiral, a downward trajectory of his life. There is nothing promising about such a life, and therefore the Gemara says, we have a right to judge him based on where he is now because we can predict into the future where he's going to go. Now let's remind ourselves of a story way back in Sefer Bereishis, the story of Hagar and Yishmael. And that is a painful story of a young child who is thrown out of his parents' home. He is left in a situation where there's no obvious or immediate plan for his survival. The Malachim, the Medrash tells us, the Malachim are arguing that Yishmael should be stripped of life immediately. Why should the world have to deal with this human being? And yet, God responds and he says, no, absolutely not. Ki shama Elokim eskol hanar ba'asher hu sham. And the Gemara interprets that to mean that, look at the cute, innocuous, innocent little Yishmael. Ba'asher hu sham. Here he is at this point of his life, he's okay. And we don't predict based on the future. We don't look at things based on a determination of what we think is going to be later on. We look at what's in front of us right now. So once again, what is the Torah's perspective about this kind of ethical dilemma? Do we judge people based on where they are now? Or do we look into the future and make a determination based on what we think is going to be their future? Do we judge people based on their current standing and merit? Or do we judge them solely on what we think is going to be the outcome? So let's study that parsha from last week once again. And we'll notice, if you look carefully in the psukim later on, you will notice that there's one phrase that is mentioned over and over again that sometimes may go unnoticed as we read it. And that is when the parents describe the situation, the Torah says that this child is a nenu shomea bikolenu. And I think in that lies this entire dilemma. God certainly understands that every human being has weaknesses. We all have inadequacies. We all have certain deficiencies. We all have certain things that make us imperfect. And that's the fact of life. The pasuk says, Ki hu yada yitzreinu. God created us. God knows that he created us with a certain side that may not be as positive as others. But that's all okay as long as one is willing throughout life to always pledge to be a listener. At some point, whenever we're ready, whenever the possibility comes into our focus, we are going to take the chance to allow ourselves to listen to those who want to help guide us. But what happens when a person feels that they are closed off from ever listening? Einenu shomea bikolenu. When somebody in life has tuned everyone else out and decided that they always know better and there is nothing they can gain from anyone's advice or anyone's direction. It is there that the Torah says there is no future for such an individual. Yishmael, by the very name that he is given, he is a shomea. It alludes to the fact that he has an uncanny ability to listen. Yishmael at his core essence is somebody who is a remarkable listener. And that is why God says, Ki shama Elokim eskal hanar ba'asher hu sham. I'm going to look at him now because a human being who's a listener is always worthy of developing, of perfecting, of enriching themselves and making life more meaningful. Somebody who is a nenu shomea bikolenu, somebody who has closed themselves off from listening, who feels they are no longer impressionable, who feels that they have a mindset that everything is finished, everything is done, and there's nothing more that I can be helped. In such a situation, God already projects into the future and tells us what the future will be of that person. I mention this because, obviously, the highlight and the centerpiece of our tefillah and our service on Rosh Hashanah is when we blow the shofar. But it's interesting. We make a bracha lishmoa kol shofar, because the most basic and fundamental element of tshuva is for a person to allow themselves to listen, to allow themselves to be influenced, to take away all of those obstructions that are in the way of our senses, and to begin to take a hold and to galvanize the lives that we lead and that we are living, and to make them more meaningful by that incredible ability to listen. So in the spirit, with that very short introduction, and in the spirit of the Tzurva program, which really focuses generally on halacha, I was asked to share a little bit of Divrei Hashkafa and a little bit of the halacha as well. So let me just touch upon, again, we don't have too much time and I don't want to keep anybody. And really, the focus of this program is not me at all. The focus of this program should really bring all of our minds and all of our hearts to Johnny and to his incredible legacy and to all that he left behind and to all that he has accomplished. So this evening is really just a kavod to him. And it's the greatest thing that all of us can be doing to gather together and do this in his honor. The most basic and foundational discussion that one can have when talking about the mitzvah of blowing shofar is, what exactly is the nature of the mitzvah? Is the nature of the mitzvah for us to blow the shofar? Or is the nature of the mitzvah for all of us to hear the shofar? Now, that's an interesting question, but it's not one that I have invented. It's a question, it's a debate, it's a dispute that goes back about 800 years to the days of the greatest of the Rishonim. The Rambam has a very clear position on this, and the Rambam writes in Hilchas Shofar, very clearly, in Perak Aleph, Halacha Aleph. So it's the very first place when you open up the Rambam and you want to understand the basic fundamentals about Rosh Hashanah, this is what you will find, where the Rambam says that the mitzvah fundamentally is that we have an obligation to hear the blowing of the shofar. And the Rambam is so explicit. The Rambam therefore follows that train of thought and says, this is the reason why we make a bracha, lishmoa kol shofar, to hear the blowing of the shofar, because the essence, the nature of the mitzvah is to hear the blowing of the shofar. Now the Rambam then goes further in a tshuva, and he tries to expand and bolster his position. And the Rambam says, if this would not be the case, if the mitzvah would be that everybody has to actually blow the shofar, then the Rambam says, we would each have to buy our own shofar, the same way each of us have to buy our own Dalad Minim, and we each have to buy our own Shabbos candles, and we each have to buy our own mitzvah items. The Rambam says we would each have to come to shul on Rosh Hashanah with our own shofar, and I would imagine earplugs so that we don't go deaf from hearing everybody around us. But the Rambam says, if the nature of the mitzvah would have been to actually blow the shofar, then he says we would all have an obligation to come with our own. After all, we build our own sukkah, we shake our own lulav, we wear our own tefillin, we light our own Shabbos candles, we do all of these things on our own, and this would be no different. This would follow in the same train of thought. And that is why the Rambam says, in his opinion, this is something that really is subject to only the mitzvah being geared toward the listening, the hearing, the shomea, the shmia, the listening of the blowing of the shofar. This is also the opinion of the Rush, as well as the opinion of the Tur. The Rush, again, the Rush did not live at the same time as the Rambam. He lived about 60, 70, a little bit more years after the Rambam's passing. But again, they were all in the Tkufa. They all lived in the same time of the Rishonim period. And they all took this position, which is that the essence of the mitzvah is to listen to the blowing of the shofar. The Rambam then brings that perhaps there's a Yerushalmi that all of this is based upon. After all, the Yerushalmi says something very interesting. After all, the Yerushalmi says that if we look at the mitzvah of lulav on Sukkos, and we think about that mitzvah a little bit, the Gemara tells us that a lulav hagazel, if somebody steals a lulav and then makes use of that lulav, now aside from the fact that you have violated the prohibition of stealing, lo signov, we all have to be honest and upstanding, we are not allowed to steal, we're not allowed to use something that is not ours. Aside from that, the Gemara says, were somebody to steal a mitzvah item like a lulav and then try to use it to fulfill their obligation on Sukkis, they have not fulfilled their obligation. And the Gemara explains why. But the Rambam says, why is it that if I steal a shofar, I would be able to fulfill my obligation, whereas if I would steal a lulav, I would not be able to do my mitzvah with that stolen lulav? What is the difference? After all, if I steal, I'm not allowed to use it. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually has an interesting tshuva, where he says, there are many well-meaning individuals who run yeshivas and who run schools, and I'm not singling anybody out. I don't know anybody offhand, so really I'm not talking about anyone. But he says, at the time that he wrote the tshuva, about 55 or 60 years ago, I believe, Rav Moshe said that there were some Jewish institutions that believed that, after all, I'm doing good work, I'm trying to educate children, and therefore I have a right to steal from the government. Because if the government gives programs, and I could take advantage of those programs, and I could somehow create a story that I am using this for my school, even though I'm not really putting the money toward that, maybe I'm doing something positive, because after all, the net gain is that all of that money that I'm taking from the government is going toward Jewish education. And Rav Moshe says, absolutely not. Do we need to go any further than the mitzvah of lulav? After all, it says in the Gemara explicitly that I'm not allowed to steal a lulav in order to fulfill my obligation. And that really extends to all mitzvahs. I'm not allowed to steal something from another human being, even if my intent is most noble. Even if I'm trying to fulfill a mitzvah, even if I'm trying to serve God, that is not a way to serve God. It is never an excuse. And yet, although we know that losignov is something that one obviously is not allowed to break or violate, the Gemara does say, the Yerushalmi writes, that we can compare and contrast the mitzvah of lulav to the mitzvah of shofar. If I steal a lulav, I violated the iser of losignov, but I have not fulfilled my mitzvah if I use it. If I steal a shofar, though, the Gemara says, I am yotzei the mitzvah. How can that be? And the Yerushalmi answers, because there's a major difference in the nature of these mitzvahs. A lulav, the nature of the mitzvah is that I need to take the lulav and use it to fulfill my obligation. A shofar does not require the item itself. A shofar requires my ears. I need to hear the blowing of the shofar. That is not a tangible item. I didn't steal the sound of the shofar. And therefore, the Yerushalmi writes that I would fulfill my obligation by just listening to the shofar, even though that shofar item itself was stolen, which seems to indicate that the Rambam says that the whole mitzvah really is, in its very essence, to listen to the blowing of the shofar. A lot more to talk about in that regard, and where the Rambam came from, and what this is based upon. There's an Avnei Nezer about this, a fascinating Avnei Nezer, where he says, I don't really understand, because the Rambam is going to lead us into a major problem. After all, why would it be the case, if all I need to do is listen to a shofar, and that is the nature and essence of the mitzvah, why would it be the case that the Gemara tells us in the third parak in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, that if I have a katan who blows the shofar, if I have somebody who's not a bar chiyuva, if I have somebody who's not obligated in the mitzvah, but yet is very proficient and knows how to blow a shofar, how could it be that the Gemara says that that person is not able to do the mitzvah on my behalf? If all I need to do is listen to the shofar, why wouldn't it be sufficient if somebody blows the shofar, even if they're not obligated to do so? How could it be that the Gemara tells us that a katan who blows a shofar is not able to help the gadol, is not able to help the adult fulfill their obligation? How is that to be understood? And that is a major question that many of the great achronim deal with. And they say, well, the answer must be that after all, if I happen to be walking by a symphony orchestra and somebody happens to be playing, instead of a trumpet, they're playing a shofar, which I'm sure we've never seen, but imagine such a thing, and it happens to be Rosh Hashanah. Do you think that that is sufficient? Can that really be? Probably not. Obviously, the person blowing that has no intent at all for a mitzvah. They're just trying to play an instrument. And therefore, the Rambam would say that that would be the same. Although it's true that the essence of the mitzvah is to hear the shofar, but it has to come from a source where somebody has in mind to actually fulfill a mitzvah. If that is true, the Avnei Nezer asks, again, just for context purposes, the Avnei Nezer was one of the greatest Jews who lived in pre-Holocaust Europe. He passed away in 1910. He was the Sachet Shavar Rebbe, so he was a Hasidic Rebbe, and also known to be not only a great Hasidic Rebbe, but a great, great Tzaddik and Talmud Chacham, and wrote unbelievable Svarim. He was the undisputed Gadol in Europe before the Holocaust. But the Sachet Shavar Rebbe writes in the Avnei Nezer that this should really lead us to a problem, because the Gemara says in Maseches Sukkah that although we all need to be involved in building a sukkah in order to fulfill our obligation on Sukkis, The Gemara does say that if you build a sukkah's ganvach, which means if I have a non-Jew who builds a sukkah, that would be acceptable. How could it be? A non-Jew who builds a sukkah, I'm allowed to sit in it, and yet a non-Jew who would build a shofar, I wouldn't be able to do my mitzvah? So how do you really draw the line? How do you figure out where is it okay, where is it not okay? And here is where you see the brilliance of the great Gedolim. The Avnei Nezer pulls us to a sugya Masechah Sanhedrin with when the Gemara talks about writing a Sefer Torah, and he pulls from there and he tries to apply it here. And that's just the beauty of Torah. This is the beauty of Tzurva. This is the beauty of how halacha develops and how halacha works, that one really has the ability to look at so many different sources and so many different seemingly disparate Gemaras and then put them all together and figure out the beauty of Torah. In essence, what the Rambam comes to the bottom line is, the mitzvah certainly is lishmoa kol hashofar, to listen to the shofar. On the other hand, on the other side of the spectrum, I should say, we have the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam was one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, and Rabbeinu Tam is of the opinion that no, the essence of the mitzvah is to blow the shofar. And the question is, if that's true, the Rush asks, how can that be? If that is really the case, then we should see every single person should walk into shul on Rosh Hashanah with a shofar in their hands. And every person should actually be blowing on their own. Can you imagine the scene? What would happen in Rosh Hashanah? We think it's complicated on Yom Kippur when everybody has to bow down and everybody's trying to make room for each other. Imagine if everybody pulled out a shofar in the middle of davening on Rosh Hashanah and everybody was blowing. I mean, how would that work? And what would be the scene? How would such a thing actually happen? So how can Rabbeinu Tam say that the mitzvah is for every individual who comes to shul to actually blow the shofar? Really? The essence of the mitzvah is to blow? Isn't the Rambam correct? And after all, don't we know, there is also a Gemara that says that if you have somebody who closes their ears and who puts earplugs in, they are not in fulfillment of the mitzvah of shofar. Why? If I'm blowing the shofar, what does it matter if I'm deaf? What does it matter if I put earplugs in? What does it matter if I can't hear? Shouldn't make a difference. I have fulfilled my obligation. Which leads many Achronim to say that obviously Rabbeinu Tam is of the opinion that we can rely on the general concept, the general principle of shlucho shel adam kemoso. If a person sends another human being as their proxy, as their agent, to stand in their place, to be their delegate, that would be sufficient. So when we have one Baal Tokea who goes to the front of the shul, our assumption is that he is serving as our proxy. I'm leaving out many of the details because I was told by Rabbi Grauer 25 minutes, and I see here on the clock I'm at 22 and a half. So I'm trying to be careful here. So again, this is the major dispute among the Rishonim. However, there is a compromise position which is adopted by many of the great Achronim, and that is there's some kind of fusion that we have to make. Obviously, the mitzvah of shofar requires that we have a shofar that is blown by somebody who is obligated, while at the same time, we have an obligation, obviously, to hear the sounds of the shofar. And here's where I want to just end off with a very important nekuda, if I may. You see, there are really two aspects to the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And this is a comment that my great teacher, Rav Asher Weiss from Yerushalayim, has told me on many occasions when we spoke about the mitzvah of shofar. And that is that really the Gemara says in essence in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that the reason why we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah is because we want God to hear. It's not as if God can't hear our voices, but we want God to be reminded of the shofar that was on the Isle of Yitzchak Avinu. We want God to remember that amazing story, that unbelievable sacrifice that Avraham Avinu was willing to give of his child. We want that to be remembered. Is there a greater schus in the world that a parent can accept the judgment of God, that a parent can accept the word of God? As difficult and as painful as that can ever be, and as horrific as that circumstance may be, and we will never understand it. But is there a greater thing that we can hand off to God on Rosh Hashanah than that? To say, God, we're still serving you. As difficult as we find it to really have a perspective and to understand what this is about, we're here. And we serve you. And we want you to hear that sound of the shofar. So on the one hand, the shofar is really meant for us to communicate a message to God. We want him to appreciate the sacrifice that we live with in life. And the fact that we're still here that we're still holding on, and we're still trying to engage in that relationship as best as we possibly can. At the same time, the Rambam writes in the third parak of Hilchos Tshuva that the reason why we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is, as is famously said, because of Uru Yishena Mishinaschem. It's meant not for God to hear, but for all of us to hear. So the truth is, we believe that we are blowing because we have a mitzvah to blow, because we want to do that and give that to God, while at the same time we cannot forget while doing so that there's a mitzvah to be a shomea. There's a mitzvah to be listening carefully, to be understanding and internalizing the message that the shofar is meant not only to give God, but to give all of us. And perhaps that gives a little bit of a deeper meaning and understanding to this discussion in the Rishonim that seems only halachic at its base level. But when you break it down and you understand that maybe there are two components. There's the tkiyah that we do really to hand that mitzvah over to God himself, to remind him of all that we live through and all that we endure. While at the same time, there is this opportunity for all of us to be a shomea, to listen and to internalize and to appreciate and understand what that message is meant for all of us. So all I can say is, once again, I thank you, the Laxes, for giving all of us the opportunity to learn together this evening. But so much more powerful and so much more special than just what is limited to the people that are on this call is the unbelievable kavod that you have given your children and the elevation that you have given your entire family by the thousands of people all over the world who are learning the Torah that you have dedicated, who are now appreciating the sweetness and the beauty of what Torah represents. As we heard from Johnny's Rebbe, how excited he was, how happy he was to be involved in Limud HaTorah. And what a greater tribute can there be than to be involved in an endeavor like this? We hope that this will be a tremendous aliyah, not only for his neshama, but for all of us as well. You know, as we say on Rosh Hashanah, the Sifrei Chaim and Sifrei Mesim are psuchim lefanav. My father has told me many times in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, what does it mean that the Sifrei Chaim and the Sifrei Mesim are psuchim lefanav? So most of us understand it to mean that God has two books, and on Rosh Hashanah, every individual in the world is going to either be put in the Sifrei Chaim or the Sifrei Mesim. My father has told me on many occasions that perhaps it means something far more profound than that. Perhaps it means the Sifrei Chaim means all of us who have the privilege of being here in the world and being healthy and thriving and having meaningful life. All of that is judged on Rosh Hashanah. But every year on Rosh Hashanah also, God opens up the Sifrei Mesim. God looks and remembers and thinks deeply and cares very intimately about those who unfortunately are no longer with us. And God looks at the Schusim. God looks at the merit that they are deserving of. How could Johnny have ever possibly imagined that he could accrue so much schus in a life that was so short, that was tragically cut short? How is it possible that Johnny could have imagined that thousands of people all over the world would be learning Torah in his memory? And every year, you should remember that those Sifrei Mesim are reimagined, that those Sifrei Mesim are looked at once again, and that God once again gives the credit and gives that great value and merit to the neshama, to the life, and the legacy of who Johnny was. Tehei nafshot tzruah b'tzorah chayim.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Schechter. What an incredible presentation. We just put in the link into the chat, a special link to a special edition of Tzurba on Shofar that we're sharing with you this evening. And I put it on the Team Lax WhatsApp group as well just now, and I'll email it around as well to everyone on the call. It is a incredible learning opportunity, and I would encourage everyone, Lui Nishmat, both Johnny and Ethan, to consider learning Hilchot Shofar between now and Rosh Hashanah or perhaps during a Seret Yemei Tshuva, this special edition that we're sharing with you right now. Rabbi Schechter, really, that was special and wonderful. We're so incredibly appreciative, and we thank you so much. At this point, I'd like to call upon a special chazan guest.